Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Rivers carry life-giving waters throughout the Earth's land systems, much like your veins and arteries carry blood through your body. They're vital to healthy ecosystems, carrying nutrients from the mountains, often all the way to the sea. Studying them has always been important and somewhat challenging. In this program, we'll examine rivers from a macroscopic to nearly microscopic level. Later on in the show, we'll hear about a promising project that looks to improve salmon habitat on one of the Sacramento River's most important tributaries for fish, Battle Creek, in the far northern Sacramento Valley. But first, we look at the big picture of rivers, literally, with a view from space. Our guest is Cedric David. Cedric is a project investigator and hydrologist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory for the Surface Water and Ocean Topography Satellite, also known as SWOT. It's operated jointly by NASA and the French Space Agency. He joins us now to talk about the latest findings from SWOT about the Earth's rivers. Cedric David, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I know that you have dual citizenship in France and the United States, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Tell us about...
Just like the SWOT mission.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's a joint mission between the United States and France. I mean, we get into that in a moment.
That's right, with partnerships of the United Kingdom Space Agency and also the Canadian Space Agency, but primarily France and the U.S.
Yes, very cool. International cooperation is always a good idea. I'll leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know a bit about you and your growing up in France. How did you get interested in science in general and especially in hydrology? How did that come about for you?
Well, okay. Oh, listen, that is such a good question. You know, I grew up on the Mediterranean coast of France, and the water has always been my happy place. Going into the sea over there, the Mediterranean Sea, it's something that we did all year long, summer and winter, warm and cold, and it's been my happy place my whole life. And so I've had a forever attachment to water as an element. And I've been, you know, growing up just interested in the environment and curious about nature. And one thing led to another, and I did science and kept doing science and got a degree in engineering and eventually a master's and a doctorate degree. And the direction was clear from the beginning. I was always wanting to study water. I ended up focusing on the world's rivers. And that's been my focus and passion for probably two decades now.
And then how did you come to the United States and to work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena?
I did a pit stop in Austin, Texas, starting in 2004, went to the University of Texas at Austin, spent a total of 8 years there between master's, PhD, and 3 years of postdoctoral research. And that was it was my first U.S. destination as a student, but I had initially come to San Diego when I was a kid to learn how to surf when I was 16. And so it was kind of a comeback to the U.S. in 2004, years later. And, you know, I thought I was just going to come for a couple of years and then go home and start my life there. And I just never went back.
Okay. And let's talk about this mission, the Surface Water and Ocean Topography Satellite, SWOT. And it was launched, it seems like yesterday, but that was in December of 2022, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, it seems like yesterday. It was middle of the night in December, and here now we launched, and then it took a few months to deploy the satellite and make sure that it was okay before we started the science measurements. And really the science part of the mission started in the following summer, so in the summer of 2023. And so this summer we'll be getting to 3 years of continuous science mission. And you're right, it feels like it was yesterday, but we've learned so much in the meantime.
And what is the mission duration?
Well, it was initially planned for 3 years. And so we should be reaching the end of the planned life cycle of the mission in the summer. Now, historically, our engineers have been good at designing satellites and instruments on satellites that live longer than initially planned for. And so it is our hope that NASA will be supportive that we keep operating the mission for much longer.
Yes, JPL hardware, those engineers, they always underpromise and totally overperform.
We try. Last I heard, we probably still have 12 years worth of fuel.
Wow.
And so, you know, if we wanted to stay longer and if everything else was functioning as designed, the mission could last a whole lot longer.
And were you at the launch?
I was, yeah.
Because I've heard one thing many times from people like you. It's that once in your life, you should witness the launch of a rocket. It's just an amazing experience. And even better if it's a rocket you're involved with.
You know, just speaking about it brings me science goosebumps. I feel self-conscious about it, but going to the Vandenberg Air Force Base or Space Force Base then was incredible. Seeing the actual rocket on which the satellite was placed at the top. So I saw the rocket on the launch pad, and then, you know, I was in just behind mission control the night of the launch. We had the opportunity to step outside and see the rocket go up. It was something like 3 a.m. And I mean, the rocket going up is already outstanding. And I have this funny selfie of myself with the rocket behind. And I got so excited. It was a selfie video. And then I realized the next day that I was taking a selfie video of me and the lamppost behind. The rocket was somewhere else.
Oh, no. And that was a night launch, right?
That was a night launch.
Those are spectacular.
And, you know, it was gorgeous. And one of the things that I think perhaps even more impressive is when the rocket comes back. And you hear a double bang, a sonic boom, mm-hmm. when the rocket approaches the landing pad. And even the landing pad there is like, it's so big. I mean, it's big like a soccer field, but the rocket always lands back at the same place. They build it really big just in case they miss the target, but they always come back at the right spot. It's
astounding.
Really
incredible.
Yeah, and that's just the beginning, because then you deploy the satellites. You have space pyrotechnics with, you know, little explosions in space that deploy arms, ultra precision arms with the antennas on it. I mean, it's really incredible. I can tell you there was a lot of high-fiving in mission control.
Well, and the mission's been working really well. Let's talk about how it works. Tell us about the instruments on there. Tell us about Karen, and tell us about how it works, how it actually maps the surface waters of the Earth.
So Karen, the Ka band radar interferometer. It's a radar instrument that functions in a way very similar to how we mapped the elevation of the land surface in the 2000 on the shuttle mission. But it uses a slightly different frequency of the radar. That is such that the signal bounces on water and doesn't bounce as much if it's not water. And so what you do is if you get signal back, you know that there was water, so it allows you to do water detection. And then by timing, the time that it takes to go from the satellite to the surface of the water body and back to the satellite, you get an estimate of the elevation of the surface of the water. And so this mission tells you where the water is and how high it is. And when you have how high it is at various locations in space, you know that water goes from upstream to downstream. And that allows you to know where water is going. So really what SWOT does is, where is water, how high it is, and where it's going.
And what kind of resolution does it have? Like how small a body of water can it detect? Like, can it detect big puddles, ponds, lakes, rivers, streams? Well, give us a sense of the resolution on this.
So the mission was intended to observe rivers of width at least 100 meters and lakes and reservoirs of size on the order of 100 by 100 meters. But it turns out that the mission is doing a lot better. Hmm. We're able to see, when we look at the intensity of the return signal, we're seeing water bodies that are much smaller than what we were hoping, that what we designed for. And so what this is telling us is the capability of the mission is probably going to be far greater than what we had planned.
And recently, I saw a news release from my friends that work for the media. relations there at JPL, who do a fabulous job. Really interesting about studying the Earth's river systems. And that really caught my attention because these satellites that we've been deploying out into space to study the Earth's water systems usually study mostly the oceans, you know, ocean, looking for the heights of the ocean, studying things like El Nino, La Nina, which are very important. But this is the first time we've really been able to globally study things like rivers, isn't it?
That's right. So SWA is not the first satellite that sees something about rivers. We've seen it with imagery satellites, the same kind of thing that you see on Google Maps, for example. However, it is the first ever mission to be specifically designed to understand surface waters. So that's rivers, lakes, reservoirs, wetlands. In addition to the oceans, and as you mentioned, we've had ocean observing missions going back to the 1990s. So we're now officially designing missions to understand the arteries of the living planet. And that's incredibly meaningful for us as a species, because this is where we started as a civilization. Most of the ancient human civilization started by the bed of great river valleys. And so this is, you know, where we started, but then we realized that it's millions of miles of rivers and streams going through the planet. And we just don't have enough time, manpower, boats, or instruments to observe it all. And so having the unique vantage point of an Earth orbiting satellite gives you access to seeing rivers like we never have before.
Yeah, you truly get a global perspective on the Earth's water system.
That's right.
Well, tell us what some of the interesting findings were in this study of basically studying the Earth's rivers, what, over the course of a year to see what kind of fluctuations. Tell us about what some of the interesting findings from that.
Yeah, so, you know, perhaps we should start by stating what may or may not be the obvious, is that river water is the most sustainable source of fresh water on the planet. Now, compared to how much water we have in the ocean, it's minuscule. It is really small. But the water in the ocean is salty, and it takes a lot of energy and effort to remove the salt for drinking or irrigation or to sustain industry. So that takes salt water out of the equation for the greater part. Then we have a lot of water in the ice caps. That's frozen, and that's pretty far away. That leaves us with about 1.5% of all of Earth's fresh water that is liquid and on continents. And now only 1% of that is in the rivers. So we're talking about a minuscule amount of water in the grand scheme of the blue planet. So it's the most accessible and most renewable because it keeps flowing and it keeps coming back all the time. It replenishes much faster than another source of continental freshwater, which is the aquifers for groundwater. But because it is so easily accessible and it replenishes so regularly, it makes it the most sustainable source of fresh water. That's the good part. Now, the bad part is it's also the most devastating source of natural disasters. And so if you've ever seen images of cities flooding after either a hurricane or just an intense rainstorm on wet snow or something like that, then you can see that rivers can do a lot of, can hurt us a lot. So we have this love-hate relationship with rivers, and we know that we really haven't been able to see them the way SWA is seeing them. So one of the first science question that SWA was designed to answer is, what is the variability of the water storage in the world's rivers? And so if we try to unpack that a little bit, we're talking about how much water we have in the world's rivers, but really how much that is changing throughout the year. And so we had never seen that before. And it's a critical component of not only water availability, but also water-related natural disasters. And not knowing how much variability there is in the water is a big, big unknown for planning. And that's what we've seen. Maybe we can start there.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory hydrologist Cedric David as we discuss the latest findings from the Surface Water and Ocean Topography Satellite about Earth's rivers. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our conversation with NASA hydrologist Cedric David from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena as we discuss the latest findings about Earth's rivers from the joint U.S.-French Surface Water and Ocean Topography Satellite, also known as SWOT. What kind of variability have you observed, and was it surprising, the amount of variability? I'm just thinking about, for example, for me right now. I live next to the Sacramento River, and it's March when we're recording this. It's St. Patrick's Day, and I'm going to be at the river later today, and I was there 2 days ago. The river level is the lowest I've ever seen it in March ever, and I've lived here for a very long time. So it's, you know, that variation in the river's flow is just, it's part of a river system and what's going on with the climate and weather and your, you know, water management, things like that. But it's so interesting to me just to see the variability in my river. Tell us about, you know, some of the things that you've learned as far as variability on river systems around the world.
Well, so before we launched the mission, we knew exactly, as you're describing, that, you know, in some parts, some seasons, some drier season, we have less water, some wetter seasons, we have more water in the rivers. And then throughout multiple years, over decades, you know, you have years that are a little drier or a little wetter. So there is some natural variability. But we didn't really know how much. We didn't know the variability in storage of rivers, just because we can't drive a boat over the millions of miles or millions of kilometers that the rivers cover on Earth's continents. And so our best guess before was to use computer models, right? Those are computer programs running on high-performance computers. It's the same type of computer models that we use to do the weather forecast. And those models they represent the best of our understanding of the Earth's environment, but they're also imperfect. And so before flying the mission, we had an estimate going from on the order of, you know, maybe 500 cubic kilometers to 5,000 cubic kilometers. We didn't know. It was an order of magnitude in the of difference in the various estimates of variability. So that's, you know, the intensity of the waxing and the waning, or the shrinking and the growing of the world's rivers. And after taking a year of observations from the SWOT mission, what we observed was about a third smaller than the smallest of all previous estimates that we had seen. And so what we saw in the first water year of the mission, from the fall of 2023 to the fall of 2024, was much smaller variability than we had ever anticipated before. By you know, it could be 30%, but depending on if you used other estimates, it's easy an order of magnitude smaller. But there is also lots of differences between big rivers of the world and smaller rivers of the world. And you know, even the mighty Mississippi in the U.S., which is our biggest river in the country here, is so small compared to other rivers like the Amazon River or the Congo River. It's just, you know, it's a portion of the total flow. Hmm.
And do we have any idea why that was such a surprising, you know, that the variability was so much less than you had previously thought?
That is such a great question. We have some possible explanations. It's going to take a few more years of missions to have, you know, a better sense of why. What we know is that the year of observations that we used in that recent study had a notable drought in the Amazon basin. Mm. And the Amazon being the Amazon River flow is about 20% of all of the river flow going from continents to the oceans anywhere in the world.
Wow.
So it's 1/5 of everything. So when there is a drought in the Amazon, the entire global water cycle takes a hit. So there is that. So that explains why we might be smarter than previous estimates. Other explanations is that previous estimates are based on computer models, and computer models are imperfect, and we just didn't have the observations that we're now getting with the SWOT mission.
Well, one of the things that I love about science in general and a mission like this is that when you get something like this that surprises you, it leads you to want to ask further questions and investigate further to figure out, okay, what's, you know, suss out what's going on here. And that leads to, you know, down the road, more science being done. Any, you know, are there thoughts about that, you know, moving forward into the future to keep studying this issue?
Yeah, I mean, so listen, the SWOT mission is opening a whole new world of possibilities. There is the science that we knew we were going to do, and looking at things like the changing storage in the world's rivers or changing storage in the world's reservoirs, looking at the currents in the ocean, looking at guessing the underwater topography in the oceans. So we knew we would be able to do that. But there are things that we're learning now that we didn't know we would capture with the SWOT mission. For example, we showed about a year ago evidence that we could capture flood waves as they're propagating downstream. So if your satellite happens to be flying at the right time in the right place, you can actually see the wave in space of a flood that is going downstream, and that might allow you to use that information for warning of downstream communities. We're also realizing that the measurement is so fine that for rivers that are wide enough, we can also see how much the river slopes to the side as it takes a turn, like you do, you know, if you watch the Olympics and bobsledding, right? You see people going down and they go up when they turn.
Yeah.
The rivers does the same thing. And knowing that side slope gives you an estimate of how fast water is moving. And so there's just all these new options that, you know, we didn't know we would have access to. And so, of course, we'll keep looking at the variability of the river water storage globally. But there are so many other things that are important for science and society that we'll probably be looking at for however long we have access to data from the mission.
And how much data is there? Is there a lot of data from SWOT that give us a sense of, you know, because when you have a mission like this, you have to collect all of this data and then store it and do stuff with it and process it. Can you give us a sense of, you know, how much data you get from this mission?
Yes, you're raising an excellent point. So the SWOT mission was the first that we flew that brought so much data back to us that we had to rethink how we design storage, archiving, and sharing of data. So to give you an example, we're downloading on the order of 1 terabyte every day. So that's one laptop. And through the processing of the data, we're generating 20. So on a daily basis, that's like 20 laptops worth of data.
Wow.
And what this tells you is that, you know, there is just no way you can start tackling NASA scale science questions by just downloading everything and running it on your computer. You have to rethink how you do analysis. You have to do a lot of pre-processing directly on the satellite. You have to do a lot of processing on the ground, store the data in the computational cloud, and even run your analysis on the cloud in order to answer some of the, you know, very basic questions that we're after, like how much water do we have on Earth? You know, those are really simple driving questions that are of importance for the entire planet. I call those NASA scale questions, right? Simple questions concerning the entire planet. But in order to answer these very simple questions, you have to design a heavily complex piece of equipment, the spacecraft, the instrument that goes on it, and then all the data and information system that goes with it is a real adventure. So SWOT was really the first that pushed us to move the
the archiving and science data system to the cloud. But since then, we've had another mission called NISAR. It's a topography mission, and that one is even bigger in data volume. So, you know, we're always going towards the more data.
And with especially with a mission like this, dealing with something as critical to society as fresh water and the availability of water, what are some of the, you know, just basic practical applications of using SWOT data for, you know, for people?
For people, it can go down to, hey, we just saw a flood upstream. Downstream communities should be prepared. You know, it could be warning systems. It can be, you know, something we haven't talked about, but through the observation of the world's rivers waxing and waning throughout the year, we're able to effectively map the shape of river channels, and that has distinct implications for navigation, as it does for understanding flood propagation and water storage. So, you know, if you're thinking about, I'd like to irrigate my crops, and we have observations of rivers and reservoirs that can allow you to make an educated choice between, do I want to use the surface water that's easily accessible right now, or should I turn my pump to deep underground and pump a resource that takes a lot longer to replenish? So it allows you to manage your portfolio of water availability in addition to helping with water-related disasters.
When you're studying rivers from space, is it possible to look at the data and characterize the rivers? Like for example, there's kind of three types of rivers that I'm familiar with. There's the freestone rivers that just flow out of the mountains over the rocks, the stones tumbling down from the mountains. They're basically created by melting snowpack. And so those usually have a high degree of variability where, you know, in late summer, you know, early winter, they can be very low flow. And when you get the melt in the spring, you know, they can be very high. And then you have spring fed rivers like the Fall River here in Northern California, which, you know, essentially kind of maintain the same level of flow year round and temperature and everything. They don't have as much variability. And then there's tailwaters that come out of dams that are controlled by us humans, like the Sacramento River. Can you characterize, you know, kind of what's going on with river systems with your data when you can look at a river in a remote place, for example?
So yes, absolutely. And your description is spot on. We're taking that description to the global scale because we're observing the world's largest rivers. And so we're able to see, you know, the rivers that flow from the northern latitudes to the Arctic and the shape that they have. And we know that those are fed by permafrost and melting snow. We're able to see the rivers of South Asia that are fed by the glaciers of the Himalayas. We're able to see the rivers of the Amazon and the Congo. You know, so those are tropical rivers with distinct climates that kind of change with regards to their location compared to the equator. So sometimes the southern part of the basin might have a different season than the northern part of the basin. We're able to see the Mackenzie River, the Mississippi, you know, the Columbia in the U.S. We're seeing portion of the Sacramento, San Joaquin in California. But yeah, so we're not only able to see the variability of the river throughout the year, but also how that variability changes throughout space. And we're also we're equally able to kind of draw a portion of the shape of the rivers for all of these rivers going from upstream to downstream. And what we're seeing is that heavily managed river basins tend to be a lot more behaved when you're looking at differences in space than natural rivers. And it makes perfect sense. But when you see the graphics of river shapes, and you think about which one is heavily managed and which one is more natural, you can see that the variability is much smaller in heavily managed rivers. So yeah, we're able to characterize a lot of the different types of rivers that we have around the world. We knew rivers are different. There wasn't any doubt about that. But when we're actually seeing the differences that we're observing, it's both expected and astonishing, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. And I'm just curious, you know, to kind of wrap this up, to get your perspective, when we look at an organization like NASA and its long history, it has an exploration aspect to it and human crewed missions. You know, there's the plans to return to the moon with the Artemis missions. And of course, the legacy of Apollo and the space shuttle and all of those great missions. But there's also this wonderful legacy that goes all the way back to the International Geophysical Year and the launching of the first satellites in 1957-58. Of studying the Earth and studying the Earth's environment. I'm just wondering if, you know, maybe you could give us your perspective on why it's important for us to study the Earth from space.
Oh, so listen, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is one of NASA's research labs, our mission is robotic exploration of the solar system and beyond. And at NASA in general, you know, we use the unique vantage point of space to understand the universe. Now, it turns out that no matter how far we've looked for planets that perhaps might be similar to our home planet, where they're close enough to the sun that they're not frozen and far enough to the sun that they're not burning and that you might still have liquid water, we have a few candidates, but those planets are, you know, hundreds of light years away. And so what that means is if you take a family on a spaceship, it's going to be generations before we get there. So we keep looking, and it's so fascinating to look at other galaxies and other planets and, you know, other suns in the universe. But then we haven't found a planet B, right? And so that makes it even more important to make sure that we understand our own planet, which is indeed part of the solar system and the universe. And when we do that from space, we're able to understand physical processes and the health of our planet in a way that you can never see it when you're just on the ground. And so, you know, the work that we're doing is kind of like, we're doctors of the planet, right? We send satellites in space, we flip them around, we take Earth selfies, and we try to make sure that we're still good, you know? And hopefully we learn a thing or two along the way that allows us to stay on this nice planet for a little longer. Until and if we ever find a plan B.
Well, I like plan A. I like this planet just fine.
I do too. It's my favorite.
The more I've learned about other places in the galaxy and beyond, and it's always fascinated me, the more I appreciate this place in space.
And that's for sure. Everybody you've ever loved, everybody you've ever read about.
Well, Cedric David, JPL scientist for the Surface Water and Ocean Topography Satellite, it's been a joy to talk to you. And it's so interesting to hear your passion about the Earth's water systems in this incredible mission.
Dave, I really appreciate your time and your interest in what we do at NASA and at JPL in particular. And thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to talk to your audience about some of the cool stuff that we find.
Thanks to our guest from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, hydrologist and project investigator Cedric David. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll find out about a potentially impactful restoration project on a tributary of the Sacramento River in Northern California to restore habitat for fish and wildlife. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. If you've never floated on the Sacramento River between Redding and Red Bluff, California, you've missed out on one of the Golden State's true natural treasures. It's beautiful and vitally important water for fish like Chinook salmon, steelhead trout, and other species. One of the most important tributaries for the Sacramento River is Battle Creek. The Coleman National Fish Hatchery, largest salmon hatchery in the continental United States, is located there, but the creek's connection with the main stem of the river has many issues that are adversely affecting anadromous fish like salmon and steelhead. Fortunately, thanks to a new $1.85 million grant from the state's Wildlife Conservation Board, Chico State University's North State Planning and Development Collective is poised to restore this vital habitat. Joining us to talk about it are Chico State restoration biologist Robert Irwin and environmental scientist Chad Pretorius. Robert and Chad, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks.
I'd like to start out with a little bit about on your background. So let's start with you, Rob. Tell us a bit about your background as a biologist and how you came to Chico State.
All right. So I started in biology in school. I went to Chico State, graduated in 2002 with a biology degree. Then I went to Humboldt State, now Humboldt Polytechnic, got a master's degree there. And started in 2016 working on fisheries restoration projects in the Sacramento River, in the upper Sacramento River basin. And primarily just been busy. I've got 9 or 10 fisheries enhancement projects under my belt, and I'm working on another one that we're going to talk about today.
And Chad Pretorius, what about you?
Well, I was just a kid that liked to fish, and the only thing that was going to hold my attention was fisheries. So I pursued a degree in fisheries. I grew up in upstate New York in the Adirondack Park and went to school in the University of Idaho. Picked up a bunch of part-time fisheries gigs in Alaska, up and down the Rockies, down in the deserts of Wyoming and Colorado, and finally made my way over to California. I floated the Sacramento River one time and never left. I spent the last 18 years with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service up out of Red Bluff, California.
Yes, and you and I have run into each other when you were in that job description many times when I was walking my dogs or going fishing. I'd like to know a little bit about how Chico State got involved in this restoration project at Battle Creek, which is a tributary of the Sacramento River.
So Chico State has been involved with river research and stewardship for several years. They have a partnership to preserve California Chinook salmon populations. And we have a restoration team that has led the construction of spawning and rearing habitat in 13 side channels across 10 restoration sites. And we estimate we've restored about 76 acres of critical aquatic habitat for juvenile salmonids and 14 acres of spawning habitat in the upper Sacramento River. And so these projects have a particular focus on critical habitat for the endangered winter-run Chinook salmon population, which is whittled down to just one wild population that spawns below Shasta and Keswick dams on the Sacramento River. So that's a big focus of our restoration.
And can you give us a sense of the size of your team and its makeup?
So our team is fairly broad. We have members of from different agencies, and so we work with NOAA Fisheries, Fish and Wildlife Service. Our engineering comes from the California Department of Water Resources. We have a lot of help from Pacific State's Marine Fisheries Commission. We have worked with the Sacramento River Forum. And so since 2019, we've worked with the Yurok Tribe's Technical Fisheries Department and their Tribal Construction Corporation. And they do the actual heavy lifting of the construction of the side channels and moving dirt and doing the project implementation.
And Chad, let's talk about Battle Creek specifically. It's a tributary of the Sacramento River, what we refer to as the Lower Sacramento River, which is basically the stretch from the dam, Redding, and all the way down to Red Bluff, which is considered the Lower Sacramento, especially amongst the fishing community. Tell us why Battle Creek is such an important part of that.
Battle Creek's a very important tributary to the Sacramento River because historically it hosted all four runs of Chinook salmon, fall run, late fall run, spring run, and winter run Chinook salmon. It also has a dedicated run of steelhead in there, as well as multiple species of lamprey and a whole host of native species such as hardhead, pike minnow, and other species. And what made Battle Creek so special is that cold water really is spring-fed from the top of the watershed. That snow melts off of Lassen. It goes down into those springs. That water sits down there for God knows how long, and then it comes up cold, clear, and fresh out of those headwater springs. And then that's what makes Battle Creek so special is that it has cold, clean, fresh water.
Okay. Give us a sense of why, what's wrong with Battle Creek that it makes it in need of some restoration work? What are the issues there?
Well, some of the issues that are going on with Battle Creek is that it was treated more like a plumbing project than it was a creek. There's multiple dams, diversion dams that were set up. There's multiple canals and different diversions. There's different powerhouses set up that divert South Fork water and mix it with North Fork water, which generally warms things up. And the more water that's diverted out of that system, the warmer that water becomes. And it becomes less of what those fish originally wanted, that clean, fresh, cold water up at the top of the watershed.
Coleman Fish Hatchery is there too. Is that part of the issues here? Some of their diversions? Tell us about the role it plays.
Oh, Coleman plays a very important role. What they have there is they have the Coleman Diversion Dam there. So they have the ability to pass fish through the Coleman Diversion Dam or allow fish not to pass through the Coleman Diversion Dam. They focus on mainly fall run and late fall run supplementation, and that's the runs that we get the fish. But like I said, Battle Creek has a very strong run of spring run, and now they're actually reintroducing winter run into Battle Creek to try to make a self-sustaining second population of winter run.
And Rob, can you maybe tell us a little bit about what are the plans for this project? What do you hope to accomplish, and what are you actually going to do at Battle Creek?
So the project has several aspects. The main point of it is to increase habitat for juvenile Chinook salmon. And so one of the things we're going to do is we're going to get some excavators and heavy equipment in, and we're going to dig out a side channel that makes a loop in Battle Creek so that a smaller amount of water can go through this channel and provide the right flows and the right depth for juvenile Chinook. We're going to go in and plug in large pieces of wood and boulders and make habitat elements so that juvenile fish can go into, you know, behind boulders and get cover under large woody debris. And and you know, then we're going to go in there and plant a lot of willows and a lot of riparian vegetation to try to create habitat for food resources. We're also going to remove two levees that are along Battle Creek. And so by removing those levees, we're anticipating that we can activate 74 acres of floodplain during annual peak flows. And so we're reactivating areas of the floodplain that have not been active since, you know, the early 19th century. And then we're also going to plant a lot of vegetation. So we're looking at over 3,000 linear feet of riparian vegetation. And the goal is that when we remove the levees and Battle Creek reactivates its floodplain, we're going to be, you know, feeding the plantings that have already happened there and the plantings that we're putting in. And so it's going to jumpstart the riparian habitat progression. And right now there's areas of annual grasses and star thistle and Himalayan blackberry. So hopefully we're going to create a more, you know, robust mosaic of habitats that will benefit other species like birds and insects.
So you're going to be removing some of that invasive vegetation.
Yeah, where we can. So Himalayan blackberry is a particular challenge, especially at this site. Many of us have gone out there to survey it and have been unable to access large tracts of it because there's so much Himalayan blackberry. So that's an ongoing issue. We also are looking at decreasing fish stranding. There's a couple areas that are known to strand juvenile fish. And so we're going to get in there and regrade them and try to get positive drainage so that fish don't get stuck.
And when you do these restoration projects, which have been happening all up and down California, a lot of it focuses on these side channels projects of creating places for these juvenile fish. Could you explain to us why these side channel projects are so important for juvenile fish in particular, Chad?
Sure. Like Rob mentioned, in Battle Creek particularly, we have three triggers that we're pulling here. We're making a side channel, we're reconnecting the floodplain habitat, and we're regrading backwaters to avoid stranding. And all three of those serve a role. The side channels are very important because it allows fish to pull over during higher flow events or even low flow events and just take their time, relax, catch something to eat, and grow to an adequate size. When those levees were in place, they kind of just forced and channelized the water and forced those fish out into the Sacramento, not on their time, but more on the flushing flow time. When we create these floodplains and these side channels, we allow the fish to operate on their time. We're putting back function into the creek, the way the creek was meant to function.
And earlier you commented that this is one of many projects that California State University Chico has been involved with over the years. Could you maybe discuss in general some of the other interesting projects? I know, Chad, you mentioned to me another vital tributary, Clear Creek. Maybe tell us what you've observed there from the work that's been done.
Okay, well, Clear Creek's CSU, our project, our team has kind of like finished up in the main stem for now. We finished up and wrapped up with Shea Island and Capusta Island this summer with our monitoring, and we're moving into those tributaries like Battle Creek, and we're helping out with a large restoration project in Clear Creek right now called the Horsetown Restoration Project. And our role is just kind of monitoring the wild fish. What were they doing before the project went into place, and then we're observing them in a restored section of the creek as well. And until I got my head underwater and actually observed what's going on in these side channels and these floodplains, it's absolutely amazing. Clear Creek is working. It's working the way it's supposed to be working. The beavers are in there chewing down the trees. The fish are hiding out in the trees. They have cover. One thing I noticed, too, is they're not schooling up as much. They're more comfortable to move out on their own because they have the cover, and they're just growing at such an exceptional rate. So we have a functional floodplain that we're monitoring in Clear Creek right now, and it's just we're learning continuous lessons from that every day, and we're taking those lessons, and we're trying to apply them in Battle Creek.
So you literally put on a wetsuit and snorkel in there, right?
We do our best to snorkel through it. We have some pretty funny pictures of our feet sticking out of blackberry bushes.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, it's not easy. It's some of the hardest snorkeling out there, but we're getting it done, and hopefully we'll have some real good footage from the GoPro of what's going on under the water, under those bushes, and see what's going on and actually see these floodplains working and functioning. And we're learning a lot of great lessons. These fish are growing at an exceptional rate.
I'm also very curious because I have seen firsthand a very close member of my family lost her job due to the withdrawal of federal funding for restoration ecology projects. And this is happening all over the place. I'm wondering, you know, how that lack of federal input and support is affecting work like what you do.
So in 2025, the U.S. government shut down for 43 days, and that was right in the middle of our permitting effort for Battle Creek. And so I don't know if anybody has done environmental permitting. It is probably one of the hardest permitting activities in the world. I mean, you're right in the middle of protected waters and riparian systems and endangered species, and you have to deal with pretty much every layer of federal government. And so when we're going through the permitting process, it could take 2 years, 3 years. And when the government shut down, all of a sudden nobody was able to help us with our permits. And so we had to just sit tight and wait for the government to open. And by the time it opened, we were behind schedule. And then we start calling people in their office, and you know, some people were gone. They lost their job, or they moved elsewhere. And the people that were still there were doing sometimes double the work that they used to. And so it made everything difficult for everybody involved. And I have a lot of sympathy for people in the federal government who are covering workloads that used to be covered by other people.
Before we let you go, I'd like to leave on a hopeful note. What do you hope to see accomplished at Battle Creek? What do you hope it looks like in years hence?
I daydream about walking out to these star thistle fields and annual grasslands that I've spent some time in, and seeing signs of overflow from Battle Creek and plants starting to grow out of the ground and the riparian starting to advance. And I'm very confident that it's going to look better
everything is going to benefit from it. Even though we're kind of focused on winter run right now, all of those runs are going to benefit. And that's what makes Battle Creek so exciting, is that we're not just building habitat, we're building resilience in a changing climate.
Absolutely. Well, Chad Pretorius and Robert Irwin from California State University Chico, Chico State Enterprises, thanks for joining us to talk about this incredible restoration work being done on the Sacramento River.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Dave.
Thanks again to our guests from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, hydrologist and project investigator Cedric David. You can learn more about the Surface Water and Ocean Topography mission at swat.jpl.nasa.gov. And from California State University's North State Planning and Development Collective, restoration biologist Robert Irwin and environmental scientist Chad Pretorius. You can learn more about the collective's work at nspcd.csuchico.edu. And just a transparency note, NSPR's broadcast license is owned by Chico State. The university does not oversee our news production or programming. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.